So, good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are in the world. Welcome to Beyond Bitcoin, a program that speaks mostly about things that aren't Bitcoin. We have to acknowledge, of course, that Bitcoin plays a very important role in the crypto economy and in the people's perception of this economy. But one also has to remember that between the 1st of January this year, when it was 71.3% of the total capitalization of the marketplace, it's now down to 41.3%. And we think this is a very important part, because what you're seeing there is you're seeing the layers of the economy getting built out from what was originally just a currency or a store of wealth. Like normal, today I have my friend and colleague with me, Nitin Gower, who's with IBM. Hello, Nitin.
Hey, Derek. Glad to be here again. It's that time of the week. My name is Nitin, and I serve as Director of Financial Sciences and Digital Assets at IBM. And also, I lead the research efforts at Portal Asset Management, trying to make sense of all the chaotic crypto world that we live in. So glad to be here.
Terrific. And today, we have our first guest that comes along and joins us. By the way, a guest we know very, very well, and that is Mark Whitten, who's the CIO of Portal Asset Management. Hello, Mark.
Hi, Derek. Hi, Derek. Hi, Nitin. Thanks for the invite. Long time no see.
Welcome.
So for those that have been listening to our last podcast, we used a term that Nitin decided he wanted to own, and I was happy for him to do that. And that was the term ignorant exuberance. And we often ask the question of, is the capitalization of some of these platforms, some of these tokens, just absurd? Is it ignorant exuberance that they exist? So we're going to wind through to talk about some of the size of these platforms and how much they're currently valued at as a trading face value, and maybe compare them with a few real world, or one would like to say in this space, legacy world, economy, legacy world companies along the way. But first, maybe let's talk about the battle of the layer one protocols that's happening over the last week. It sounds exciting, and I think for investors it is exciting. So most of you will know, and Nitin will do a much better definition of this, but I'm going to do as simplest definition as I can. And that is, layer one protocols are essentially the accounting system, the plumbing or the ocean of which commerce, this digital asset commerce, is operating upon. And that protocol at the moment is dominated by Ethereum, which I'm sure all the listeners have heard about. And it's getting chased very quickly by Solana, which is a fast moving protocol and has considerable advantages, which we'll get to soon, and followed then by Cardano, et cetera, and Polkadot as we go through. And this week, Anatoly Yakunenko, sorry about that, who's the co-founder of Solana, made some pretty cutting statements. And he turned around and he said, ETH2 is trying to pull a cart with 100 chickens, and Solana is trying to pull the same cart with 100,000 horses. It's a lot easier to get 100,000 horses to go fast than 100,000 chickens. Well, yes, but I very quickly saw that we've had some fairly bright people that turned around and said, hang on a sec, BTC focuses on proof of work, not Ethereum. Solana sacrifices decentralization for performance. No one calls ETH2 anymore. And there aren't 100,000 nodes for Solana. In fact, it's a large chunk of them are located in a couple of data centers. So the fight between these two layer ones seems to be a reduction of decentralization, therefore the provision of something that is delivering a much higher performance and transactions per second rating. So over to you, if I can throw it across. Here we are in the middle of this battle, and both sides have got a really valid statement, have they not, Nitin?
Absolutely. I think this has been, a super interesting debate, especially the week when we have seen Cardano and Solana really take the stage, I would say the center stage. And primarily because I think Avi Fellman, one of the co-portfolio managers of Block Tower Capital, I think he mentioned that the EIP 1559, which was the proposal to reform the Ethereum, was a lot of, it was a lull in narrative. And in absence of that narrative, I think Solana's recent surge is an indication of the fact that the market as well as the industry needs something much more robust. So let's take a step back, which will explain what layer one is. And I think, Derek, you did a fantastic job in explaining at a very basic
kind.
Level.
And, very kind.
And I'll tell you, I also love the entire whole notion of an expansion of the irrational exuberance, the famous words that Alan Greenspan had mentioned, to an ignorant exuberance is what's going on, like with the whole valuation exponentially growing up in a week or 2 weeks. And there's a reason for that. And I think, you know, layer one is the foundation. Layer one is blockchain at the very basic level. And blockchain provides a few things. It provides a transaction system. It provides the basic layer that records our movement of NFTs or DeFi assets or tokens. Not just the native tokens that are sort of the foundation of layer one, but also many of the derivative tokens, which is basically decentralized finance or non-fungible tokens and identity tokens. And the battle of L1, as you have mentioned it, that for the longest time in my career, almost a decade in blockchain space, we've always agreed that there will not be one blockchain that rules them all.
Yes.
And that was pretty evident early days when Bitcoin and Ethereum sort of carved this place to say Bitcoin is store of value. Ethereum brings programmability to a layer on top to be able to allow movement of asset with some business logic built into it. And that are smart contracts, right? Mm. And then the fight became to say, okay, what does Ethereum specialize? Still a large experiment. And you begin to then see a rational approach to solving the challenge of Ethereum, which is largely security performance, as you rightly mentioned. That moving from 15 transactions to, let's say, 1,000 transactions, which is the analogous to the card of chickens and horse, as they say, and Solana is going after 50,000 transactions per second. I think all of this conversation really leads to scale. Can we get a global infrastructure that allows the entire world, because we are building global system just like internet, can it reach that level of scale at a cost that doesn't break the bank? No pun intended. And from that perspective, that battle ensues. So I'll take a pause, just get your thoughts. I think we've been debating this in terms of investment avenues and what gives a token value. I think both Mark, myself, from a research perspective, have been talking about, you know, how do we discern between some of the metrics to measure these tokens and what really gives it value. There's a lot to unpack there, I think.
Look, it's funny that now I'm talking to some of the more speculated friends that are part of, of my WhatsApp feed, et cetera, along the way. Now, remember, this is this fun world of speculation, is playing with tokens. This isn't portal asset management. It's not our strategy. It's not what we do. But it's interesting to watch this side and see the speculative flow going. And I can't help but see the human side of it. All of a sudden, there are people on Team Solana and Team Ethereum. For crying out loud, this is not a football game. This is what is best solution for the certain areas and for for the relevant use cases of it. And they are, non-fungible tokens possibly versus financial transactions that might occur. They might be a different use case for both of them. But just looking at a few of the current transactions per second here, I noticed that Binance Coin does 100 transactions per second, Cardano does 1,000, Polkadot does 1,500 transactions per second, Avalanche does 4,500 transactions per second, and Solana is currently doing supposedly 65,000 transactions per second, and Ethereum 2 is doing 100,000 transactions per second. So that's the goal, I think, of Ethereum, because I don't think it's there yet, but 100,000 transactions per second still being out front. So Nitin, why is Ethereum so expensive to do transactions with?
Yeah, so today I think Ethereum was built on proof of work, an extension of, what they did was Bitcoin was an initial success. It still is a hugely successful experiment. I'm using the word experiment because we're still learning a lot from the whole process. And I think the advent of Ethereum that came from that experiment was, let's build a layer of logic, which is what smart contract is, on the same proof of work, because it's a proven model for a truly trustless system. And I use the word trustless because the trust is built into the protocol, truly element of decentralization, which is figuring out the global computer. And Ethereum basically came with the model of saying, we are building a global computer, which is one computer, and you basically put stuff through it and things get processed and things get, you know, spit out. And that's sort of your record of those transactions. And because it was built on proof of work, it had the inefficiencies of computation because it is relying upon what we call as a consensus mechanism of all computers and all systems agreeing upon a certain set of things. And that quickly fell short. I think CryptoKitties was the first example experiment when Ethereum networks were clogged and it became too sort of slow with 15 transactions per second. And if you're truly aspiring for a global computer, a global system, you have to start with an aspiration of serving 8 billion people. That's essentially the ask there. And to be able to serve 8 billion people, to let's say even if half the world is awake at one given point in time, then 15 transactions per second doesn't cut it. 100 transactions per second doesn't cut it for some use cases. So all these level one protocol want to have the lowest common denominator to say, hey, let's start with something industrial grade and work our way backwards to say, hey, if we can support 50,000 transactions per second or 100,000 transactions per second, there are blockchains who claim 1 million transactions per second. You're laying the bar high to say, suddenly now you can engage in a peer-to-peer transactions between, let's say, 4 billion people and serve the market in almost near real time, which is essentially, you know, what the objective of many of these blockchains are. And so that volume is really towards, you know, an aspiration to serve the globe. And I wouldn't use the word global domination, but that's where this is all heading.
In 2018, I remember talking with somebody from MasterCard, actually, and it was in Sloane Square in London, back in the days when you could travel. And we were sitting at a cafe having a croissant, and this fellow looked very dignified. And I asked what he did, and he said he was in the C-suite in MasterCard. And I said, oh, very good. And he said, what are you doing here? And I said, I was coming to a blockchain conference. And that's where the conversation came pretty much to an end, because he didn't want to talk to me after that. But really, it was that cold. But at the time, I did get a question out, and that is, you know, how many transactions per second approximately did MasterCard do? And I remember the number, it was something like 68,000 transactions a second by memory. I might be wrong. You would know this space much better than I. Is that about correct?
Yeah, I think they're, so that's sort of right, but they that's the maximum they serve, especially for holiday season, because people spend a lot of money, they use a lot of cards. So both MasterCard and Visa, they have a maximum limit, which is the limit that they tout usually for holiday season, because the use of cards go up exponentially high during holiday season. But on an average day, their goal is 2000 TPS or 2000 transactions per second, only because MasterCard and Visa have a very decentralized processing element that if you're in Asia and you swipe your card, all of that doesn't go to a centralized system in the US. And they are aspiring for regional support for 2000 TPS. But during holidays, especially in the US, that number is anywhere between 20 to 60,000 transactions per second. And they have the ability to scale up to meet the demand, because you don't want to be waiting in line for 20 minutes for your transaction to be approved. Right.
Well, that's fabulous, because you just put this in context. So these numbers that we're seeing here with Solana at 65,000 and the aspiration of Ethereum at 100,000, they're serious numbers. Those are the numbers that are capable of being able to transact the world then.
Absolutely. And I think that's the aspiration of many of these. In fact, there was a recent alliance announced by Celo, a project which is using your mobile devices as a computational endpoint. It's called DeFi for People, essentially bringing the decentralized financing, which is only limited today, which by the way, 68% of all the DeFi assets are confined to the Western world. And Celo, which is basically, you know, a consortium of Aave and Pool Token and a few other projects have got together and talked about to say, hey, can we bring this to the masses? And with that level of, you know, and these are all layer three protocols. You know, we talked about layer one, but if you look at many of the projects like Aave and payment systems, they're operating at three layers above, which means they need the level of scalability should they want to reach to every corners of the globe. So it really matters to them that the underlying protocol that they are building upon supports that level of, you know, that expansion of the transaction volumes if they aspire to grow. So it's equally important, not just for layer one, but all the projects that are being built on those layers this is why the battle is so interesting, I think.
And so, okay, so Solana's way cheaper and it's faster. So it's much better than Ethereum then, right?
So I think this is where things get interesting, right? This is all potential. So the reason why the value of Solana has gone up in the past, I would say all of August, is one, they have seen, they have caught on to a few DeFi projects and many NFT projects. I think Degenerate Ape is an interesting one, or Degenerate Ape Academy. I like the term
and
that goes, I think they have taken some of the NFT projects, and NFT, as you know, has a much more expansive goals than DeFi. And I think that the industry sees the growth in demand, like NFTs are still emerging. DeFi has plateaued after almost a year and a half of growth. NFTs are still exponential. So I think what the industry, and I think Mark will, it'd be great for Mark to comment on this, is I think what industry is looking at is saying, after 10 years, what we've seen Ethereum do, if we were to apply the same level of growth with something like Solana or Cardano, this simply represents an exponential growth, and we haven't seen any of it yet. I think that's the exuberance, if I may use that term. I don't know if it's irrational or if it's ignorant yet, but that's the that's the exuberance that the industry is really banking upon.
Yeah, very true.
So Mark, I'd love to get your take on this. I know we talked about stock to flow models. As we looked into Ethereum, we internally from research perspective, we have talked about, how does Ethereum get its value, and if it's really justified in terms of its base unit price of Ethereum, which is used as a transaction, a mechanism.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts in terms of from an investment angle when you look at these things as the value drives the consumption of these tokens?
Thanks. So I think, so looking at where we are, first of all, in the cycle, I think we're moving away from what I would call a Bitcoin-dominated market, where DeFi, smart contracts, NFTs are starting to sort of gain independent valuations. People aren't looking at it as joined in the hip to Bitcoin, because you've gone from, proof of work to proof of stake, and now with Solana, you have this combination as proof of history, right? And I think what people are starting to realize is that, yes, it's the same as Ethereum in that it's a platform as well as a token, but it's so much faster, and because it's so fast, then congestion and fees should remain a lot lower, and therefore you should be driving more traffic through it, and then developers will hope that these high speeds and low fees will be able to continue building scale. It's almost like, I always think of it in terms of I always talk about the Google and Yahoo, when they were kind of neck on neck, and then Google figured out how to drive more traffic to their web, and therefore there was more advertising, and that attracted more traffic, and it became a virtuous cycle, almost like the sort of the flywheel concept. I think what we're trying to understand in terms of monetizing this, and we can get into fundamental valuations, which in some instances are not really relevant in this space, because a lot of these technologies are still nascent, and we're not quite sure, who are going to be the winners and who are going to kind of fade into obsolescence. Mm-hmm. So, we've got to figure out, when I say where are we in the cycle, there was the initial, if you remember in the dot-com boom, you had the initial infrastructure boom, and you had the oracles of the world and so on. And then you had the second layer where a lot of companies started, and people thought maybe they'd missed the dot-com boom. They were like, oh, it's too late by the year 2001, 2002. But then there was the next layer of boom, and then you saw the rise of e-commerce, and then you saw the layer after that in terms of social media apps and so on, and then you saw the layer after that, which was gaming and esports. So I think what I'm getting at is that a lot of these ecosystems that we're starting to see emerge that weren't really on the radar, like DeFi was nowhere a year ago, and NFTs weren't even on the radar a year ago. Now all of a sudden it's like, it's gone from the summer of DeFi to being the summer of NFTs. And I think what I'm getting at is that there's going to be, as there are new applications and as there's new scalability in the likes of Solana and Cardano, in some ways I agree with Derek in that it's not a competition to see, who will emerge as the clear platform, because I think there's going to be room for quite a few. I think from my point of view, I'm not quite certain or not quite sure as to which developers which technology and which platform developers prefer using. That to me is kind of not clear at the moment because I don't have insight to that extent. But what I do know is that it seems that Solano, like you spoke about with the Degenerate Ape Academy, like they are moving in the right direction. They seem to have a vision in terms of driving traffic and driving developers, you know, to their platform. Will they compete and will they be able to compete with the centralized payment processes like Visa and MasterCard and PayPal? I think not only will they be able to compete, I think they're going to outcompete them from a, you know, from a fee and a processing point of view, because if this is what they've done in call it the last 2 years, 2 to 3 years with very limited balance sheets, like, can you imagine as people start realizing the applications, what they're going to do in the next 3 to 5 years with almost not to say unlimited, but with much bigger balance sheets as people realize, you know, the applications and the potential for applications that are there, that are coming down the pipe. So that's where when I look at this, I think to myself, where are we in the cycle? Because like we've decoupled from Bitcoin to an extent, and Bitcoin's part of this, but it's not what's driving it. And like, where are we with DeFi? And I still think I don't feel like we've missed the boat at all. I think there's still many, many layers that are still coming on top of what we've seen at the moment.
So here's an example of that, and that's brilliant, Mark. And I'll just like to highlight a few things that you mentioned with some examples, right? So I do a lot of experiments, one, to understand the space. Second thing is, it's part of research. Is best thing to do is to learn, is to do it. I've transferred a few USDC tokens from my, let's say, Coinbase account to my my MetaMask account, and it almost cost me $5 to move $50, which is an exorbitant fee, just to be able to move, just to pay a transaction fee, and I had to wait 15 blocks because of the cost structure behind the lowest priority payments that you had to do. Second thing I did was I wanted to take part in one of the NFTs from Superworld. Remember Harish, who came on one of our panels? And for me to be able to participate in that, I had to spend almost $150 as fees to acquire $250 worth of land or, you know, in this, you know, metaverse. So that's all on Ethereum. And at the time, Ethereum was anywhere in the same range as today, $3,300 a piece. And so as an educated consumer, I'm looking at this to say, hey, what is the cost of entry? What is the barriers to entry for me to say, while I'm acquiring this non-fungible token or a crypto asset, am I paying more transaction fee over time than what it's worth? Comes in Solana, 0.01 cent a transaction. I bought a few NFTs today, and I paid $50 for, let's say, one of the, you know, the ape, you know, the Lazy Ape Yacht Club, NFTs, and it cost me just a cent. And I think it's profound because suddenly now I'm attracted towards finding projects that doesn't take away 30% of my overall value of the asset that I'm acquiring, leave alone the growth of those assets, which may or may not happen. Not to mention, I don't expire like many of the NFT projects, especially around sports. It's basically collection. It's about participating in the fan experience, which is not exactly seeking appreciative value in these tokens over long term. To me, that ecosystem is important. Right, is ecosystem in terms of attracting consumers at a cost point that's amenable to not just the developers, but also the scale at which you're trying to grow. And that's where Ethereum was questioned over and over again. And with this EIP 1559, which was the recent sort of fee structure restructuring, made it a bit more deflationary asset, which the cost really drove up. So to your point, Do you think, Mark, as you mentioned, it's about attracting that developer ecosystem because developers want their project to be consumed, which means developer wants to attract Nitins of the world to go and buy more NFTs. Don't you think the developers are now looking at this and saying, let's also work on Solana and Cardano in addition to Ethereum, and let's see who wins, as opposed to moving the entire ecosystem over, which may take some time?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, you know, like I said, mentioned earlier, you went from proof of work to proof of stake, and now it's proof of history. I'm sure there's going to be another iteration at some point, which will make things even cheaper and faster. I don't know what that is. But I think that, you know, the likes of the likes of developers are kind of, I think they're agnostic as to what they're using. They're obviously concerned around, you know, bugs and failures in the protocol. That's their main concern, is they don't want to be hacked, or they don't want things to go wrong and they get lots of, you know, failed transactions. But you know, like every other evolution, what seems amazing when it's first discovered slowly starts becoming like ordinary as we adapt to it. And then it's kind of like people are looking into the next frontier. I don't have insight in terms of what the developers are doing. What I do see in terms of the hype is that, you know, Solana seems to be at the forefront of attracting some really great projects. You know, yeah. I mean, like you spoke about. Plus, you know, in traditional finance, let's say we were talking about a VC investor, and that's what you're looking to do, is to buy into a project, like a gaming business. You know, and this is a real life example, because that's what I did. And a few years back, I bought into a gaming business that was building a virtual reality games for, like, you know, one of the top brands in the world. But the process of buying into that business was like a long and cumbersome process with lots of legal fees and lots of risk and no liquidity. Once you're in, you can't get out, and so on and so forth. And you're backing this project with a 7-year view, and knowing that there's probably going to be, you know, the next stage of funding required and so on. And it's very time consuming and laborious. Whereas in this instance over here, like you said earlier, you took a look at something, you thought from a project perspective, this looks interesting, you know, I want to invest, or I want to participate in this run in NFTs and so on. And you know that if you decided to go back online tomorrow, the transaction cost is not going to be a factor in your decision to hold or sell this, right? Because whereas in the VC world, if you wanted to exit something, you need to take a 30 to 40% discount from a liquidity point of view to get out. Yes. So I think what we're seeing is, you know, it's just, I spoke about it in our last webinar a while back, saying that DeFi smart contracts and these exchanges and these platforms, what they're doing is just enabling a much more efficient way of aligning capital with factors of production and with projects that are hungry for capital, that are looking to do new and exciting things, whether it's in the world of finance or gaming. And it's a lot more seamless and a lot cheaper and a lot quicker. And I think the third part that comes in is that it's immutable. So, you don't need the trust aspect there, which is what in a VC deal, there's a lot of trust. You're trusting the management team you're trusting all the contracts are in place. Whereas in this instance, like, you don't need to build that. You don't need to worry about that.
Right.
Valuing them is another story. Like, you know, if you look at what we're trying to achieve by lining them up and looking at them and saying, you know, who do you want to bet on? At this point in time, I think it would be very risky to back one at the expense of the others.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's like no one knew, you know, whether Google, Yahoo, what was the other ones? I don't even remember. Bing.
Netscape.
All the other search engines that we had at that point in time. Like, no one knew who was really going to take the lead. And it's the same with some of the streaming platforms. I remember a time when Netflix was seen as like a no show. It was never going to get off the ground. The same as, you know, Amazon was a bookstore, online bookstore. So it's hard to say, well, do we look at this from a market capitalization point of view? Do we look at it from a price to sales? Are there these metrics in place? I mean, there's market metrics like the token trading volume to its market cap and, you know, take rates and so on, but there's not a lot of like metrics that give you a quality assessment or an evaluation assessment to say this is seen as a high quality token, which for me would be the better bet. Even if it's more expensive, I'd rather have the Mercedes-Benz, if that makes sense. I'd rather have the best quality that I can afford, because I think over time, developers, as we always know in life, people will pay a little bit more away for peace of mind rather than just, you know, cheap and nasty. And that's what I think.
That might be also part of the sort of the compartmentalized or sector relating to this. So the very large volume dollars are getting transacted on something that is truly multiple node proof of stake. And the smaller transaction dollars might be getting transacted on the Solana versus. Because one of the things we're seeing here is that Solana turns around and uses this 100,000 chickens and horses argument, but a large chunk of all of their servers are located in only a couple of data centers. So they're centralized. Okay. Mm-hmm. And so we kind of, everyone's going, I don't care about that. It's cheap. It's trading. It's cheap. Well, you know, just recently I attended Edith Cowan University's Cyber Espionage Center It's the 10th biggest in the world, and it's five stories high. And the top section of it has got the federal police in it, and the next section down below that has got the military in it, and then there's a floor in between, and then there's the students that attend the bottom, and they've got 1,300 students studying studying cyber espionage. And so the debrief was interesting. He used the word hacker once, and he said, and now I won't use this word again, because they don't consider them hackers. And he made it quite clear. He said that it's no longer, you know, hackers in bedrooms wearing hoodies. These are governments that are hacking, and they're hacking for large amounts of money. North Korea being, you know, a wonderfully interesting entrepreneurial group when it comes to international hacking, not necessarily living within North Korea. China, Russia, Iran, lots of these countries are big hackers. Well, what better to hack than something that's got tens of billions of dollars in it? And that's Solana. And if they could get a 51% hack on that because of its structure, then that must be interesting to them. When hacking Bitcoin is bloody hard work, so is hacking Ethereum. So there's a downside. What do you think of that? I mean, you know, it's just highly risky. Is that correct?
Yeah, and let me add to that, Derek, because this is super interesting. This is the world I live in. So 51% attack is what we call a Sybil attack, and that's possible in a proof of work scenario because of the fact that you need 50%, 51% to be able to make decisions, reverse, you know, your ordering and everything else. For proof of stake, which is what Solana is all about, those 51% conversation doesn't add up only because of the fact that it's the Sybil attacks don't work on the consensus mechanism like proof of stake. You have to go through what they call as a collusion, which is you have to collude with other participants to agree upon the transaction finality, and the 51% attack doesn't apply to that thing. Yeah. But what you mentioned is so pivotal in this space. So Solana today is offering a 400 millisecond response time. 300 millisecond is, so whenever you go to Google, if you time it, it's about, the internet round tripping is about 300 millisecond in a good, on a good day, on a good connection, mm-hmm. which means the request mm-hmm. goes from your computer all the way to some data center and back, and a good connection should give you about the speed of light metrics, about 300 milliseconds. So if they're offering you 400 millisecond response time for transaction processing, it means two things. It means that they're going after what they call as a quasi-decentralized model, which is let's not go after decentralization, but let's go after distribution. What that means is I'm going to distribute these servers so that I'm not putting all my eggs in one basket and creating a honeypot. Let me go over four or five data centers, and I can distribute the computational element to take advantage of physics, because I can move things between, I can take advantage of the high-speed latencies, which is a contributing factor into transaction per second, the conversation we had a few minutes back. Mm. Now, there's a subtle difference, Derek, in decentralization distribution. So all decentralized systems are distributed systems, but decentralization is more like a governance mechanism. So while you can quote unquote hack or, you know, take advantage of any technical vulnerabilities, but in blockchain world, to be able to seize, you know, with exception of private key conversation that we've had many times, that keys get stolen and that gives you access to the assets, but to be able to quote unquote hack these networks, you have to essentially participate in the consensus, which means you have to bring the tokens and you have to participate actively. And that sort of breaks the traditional model of breaking into from a cybersecurity realm, breaking into a secure system and stealing information and stealing keys, which gives you access to or right or claim to the tokens. And so the subtle difference, and I think where Solana is heading, in my opinion, is going after distribution model to take advantage of physics and provide latency and throughput and not relying upon miners in the basements, and saying that you can participate in this in a decentralized way by staking SOL, which is their token, and participating in that decentralization of governance as opposed to decentralization of the infrastructure, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does. All right. So look, I said before, we're going to do a bit of comparison between traditional, or some of the, this industry will call it legacy industries. That's a bit harsh. but here we go. Here's some numbers, because I want to throw out the thought of, like, where does this sit? Where do these valuations sit? So Solana's valuation, by the way, is $43 billion, but fully diluted at $74 billion of capitalization. And Ethereum's current cap, this is of today, so, and the date today is the 8th of September. So that's $380 billion capitalization. So the DeFi sector's, obviously not including Ethereum, is capitalized about $79 billion. And all digital currencies today are capitalized at $1.79 trillion. And if you think that sounds a lot less than our last podcast, you're right. It's dropped 15.7% in the last 24 hours. Not unusual for this space of high volatility. So there's some numbers for you. Okay. BHP Group is the largest mining company on the globe. They capitalized at $154 billion, and they're the biggest supplier of iron ore, coal, and copper in the world. Visa is capitalized at $496 billion. Now, Walmart is capitalized at $410 billion, and it has 10,500 stores and 2.2 million people employed. So, two things we know here: Ethereum has only 125 employees and is capitalized at $380 million. And I guess there's a damn good chance those employees dress better than a lot of the attendees of Walmart dress. However, just look at the dichotomy and difference between these. 10,500 stores, 2.2 million people work for it, and it's at about the same capitalization as an algorithm is. Is this our space here? Is this ignorant exuberance? Or are we saying, well, that's a legacy industry. We can calculate that on price earnings ratio, but we have no idea how to calculate the computer of the world. What do you think, both of you? What do you think, Mark, Nitin?
Okay, so if we look at the, so the company's like Walmart, right? 410 billion, and it's like 5,000 stores, I think you said.
10,500,
yep. And all that stock. I mean, I think Walmart's seen more as a real estate business than a retailer these days. Mm. But BHP, you know, all these companies are ex-growth, first of all. So Walmart's not going to be growing its revenue at, you know, 30, 40, 50% per annum in, you know, into the future. And the multiple reflects that. BHP is, you know, I think mining is possibly one of the worst, most difficult businesses in the world, should we say, in that it's very difficult to, you know, you're a price taker in terms of what iron ore and copper and coal and so on. And also the cost of projects is subject to inflation in terms of oil and employment and so on. So I think a lot of what you need to understand in terms of trying to apply old world metrics is that they're ex-growth. 90% of the businesses that are listed are ex-growth. You've seen a push in the tech space, the likes of Amazon and Apple and so on. Because there was the shift to home-based working during the lockdown. Mm-hmm. But even there, I look at that and I'm like, well, how much shopping can people do online? And how many movies can you watch? How many more subscribers can Netflix have? How many more people will join Facebook? I think they're all sort of plateauing. They're all ex-growth. Mm-hmm. The difference in this space is looking at the likes of Ethereum and Solana and Cardano is that I don't think we've even begun to imagine the applications that are going to be built down the line. And I'm not sure, like I've maintained, and I've said this before, I don't think Bitcoin will be the biggest token in the next 5 years. I just don't. Mm. Same as at one stage, the biggest companies in the world were construction businesses. You know, and you go back into the early 2000s when the world was one giant construction site. All the top companies in the world were miners and construction businesses. And now the last 10 years, it's been social media and e-commerce businesses. And I think everybody says, this is the new, it's something new. I don't think there's anything new under the sun except the way that you connect money to opportunity. So the way that you value, from the way I've been trained and in sort of many years of trying to understand, devoting my life to trying to understand what drives pricing and what drives human behavior and what drives market pricing, it always kind of boils down to one thing, and that is your long-term expected return on invested capital. I mean, that is going to be it. If what is the gross rate of return that's going to be generated per dollar of liquidity provided? And you can put that dollar to work in Walmart, where the return on invested capital will be probably with a dividend 10 to 15% a year. Or you can put it to work in the like of an Amazon, where it will be, I don't know, 15 to 25% a year, if you believe their rating. Or you can put it to work in Ethereum. And as these, or Cardano, Solana, and as these applications grow, and as the speed increases and the cost continues, as they get scale, because I mean, that's the only reason Amazon does so well is because it's got scale. It outcompetes its competitors by keeping pricing down, same as Netflix. They almost lost money to win market share. And I think that's what we kind of, in this instance, it's not that they're going out of their way to lose money. The exchanges are just trying to make it, well, the platforms in terms of development are trying to make it as cheap as possible because they want to attract developers. So I think that for me is going to be the determinant of whether this is a bubble or not. There's always going to be, you know, certain new developments, some of these being NFTs that I kind of look at when I see an art piece, which is subjective. Art is not an objective thing. It's a subjective thing. It's you like it and that's why you're buying it. But when an art piece, a digital art piece, goes for $70 million or $69 million, that to me, I kind of starts looking a bit silly. But then again, you know, it's more of a bragging right, potentially, like buying a football team. You know, it's like, it's not a good business. Okay. To bring it back to just our conversation on what we're talking about with Solana, I think if we had to rank them side by side, whether it's Ethereum, Solana, Cardano, all the other ecosystems that are out there, it's like, where do you believe your best return on invested capital, which ultimately means free cash flow generation, which of these platforms is going to provide that? Because one might be a lot cheaper, but it may be way faster. And therefore, you've got this, you know, it always boils down to price times volume. And the price is always going to be this drive to the bottom. But volumes is where we're going to see the real, because we haven't really seen, like, think about it. We're still talking about however many hundreds of thousands of transactions or 50,000 transactions per second. If one of them becomes the standard adopted way of doing business, I think it could be, you know, a lot more in terms of what's out there, in terms of demand, like transactions per second. It's not going to be, the demand's not going to stop at 50 or 60,000. The demand is potentially 5 or 600,000.
Yeah, I think that was brilliant, Mark. Just to add a few things, Derek, to your question. As Mark described, that putting a dollar into Walmart, I think there's a expected ROI that we expect only because these are matured industries. And over time, they've extracted all the inefficiencies and given the higher shareholder value. And now there's a certain expected return for every dollar that I invest in these mature industries. But I think many of the, whether you call it speculative or potential valuation models of these tokens, which combine, you know, like there was another analysis done where Ethereum today represents 80% of JPM, which was the question that was asked, that, you know, JPM is a bank, it's an established over 100 plus years old bank, and suddenly now Ethereum, that's little over a decade, is, you know, its market cap represents about 80% of JPM. But I think, like most technologies, technology stocks and technology, you know, technology generally is deflationary. Like what you pay for iPhone back in the day and what you pay for now, I think there's a comparison done that, you know, it's an incremental value, but, you know, every time that a new iPhone comes out, exponential advancements made both in terms of code, in terms of chipsets, in terms of camera. And so I think in general, technology is deflationary. It over time reduces the cost based on consumption, based on innovation. And that's the beauty of most of the tech entities. And just like internet, and I think we've compared our existing, the way we analyze our protocols in crypto world to similar to that, what we've, you know, seen at internet era, early days, the foundational elements of internet were quite highly valued and priced. Mm-hmm. And I use the word pricing and value distinctively here, is because there was a potential which no one really understood what the return is going to be. But over time, as we have seen, semiconductors came down to be super cheap. Operating systems were free. No one really began to pay for compression technologies because they become part of our lives. And suddenly now you begin to see the application of these in eBay and Amazon. And suddenly Amazon was able to harness the network effect and take a cumulative advantage of all the deflationary impact in the ecosystem, combine them to give you an amazing value. I think this phase we're in now is early days of internet, where all these, there's a potential to all of these protocols, and eventually in a couple of winners will emerge that will sort of compress the entire value chain and give us that value. And that is something which is yet to be seen, I think.
So then really, we're not looking so much at ignorant exuberance. What we're looking at here is this exponential growth potential. Not all of these protocols are going to win this exponential growth potential, but some of them will. And when those exponential growth potentials are going to come in, it's going to be not dissimilar to when the internet came in and everyone thought it was a place to put websites and send email, to it becoming a massive sales site and an enormous communications platform. We didn't anticipate that. And possibly that's what's happening here. We're all anticipating there's going to be exponential growth in these extraordinary algorithms and these enormous infrastructures. We're just not sure which one is going to have the most exponential growth. Therefore, the prices of these protocols solidly priced in anticipation of that.
Yeah.
No, I agree. That's how I really look at it too.
So I'll just say...
The only other thing I'd say, just sorry, Derry, is if I look at, you know, you've got ignorant exuberance and then there's irrational exuberance. And I look at that, to me, buying a house, let's say probably the most overpriced luxury property market in the world, let's say Sydney is right up there with them, and expecting it like to double again in the next 5 years is irrational exuberance. It's a greater fool theory of, oh, someone else is going to be crazy enough to pay, you know, $20 million for a house that I've bought for $10 million, which is probably only worth five in a normalized environment. And I think this is not irrational. What we're seeing in terms of some of these pricings, excluding, like, let's say the art example, which I don't know how much utility that has, but someone does have a plan there. But I don't think this is irrational in that, you know, what have we really seen out of Solana and Ethereum and how many DeFi projects have there been? How many smart contracts, like how much has been done so far? Considering to now that a year ago, it was kind of not really being taken all that seriously. People weren't, you know, and where we are now, where we're going to be in 2 or 3 years as capital really starts flowing into the space, because we know, you know, anecdotally how many new funds are coming to market. We know that the lead time and to set up a new fund is extended to a couple of months because the administrators and the lawyers are kind of quite overburdened. There's just so many new products coming to market, VC, private equity, but also new funds that are looking to specialize. You know, anecdotally, we just invested in a fund that is specializing in network participation. It's Web 3.0. That is what they do. And they're a very niche fund, and their returns are, because they understand their space, the returns are spectacular. Yeah. And I think that's where we're at the beginning of that. It's kind of like saying, I'm a tech-based fund when there are only like five tech companies listed. You know, look at what you had in front of you. If you were big into tech, if you ran a proper tech fund and managed to survive the dot-com crash, and you had tech specialists, look at how many IPOs there were. Look at all the new technology and look at all the businesses that were bought. There's a lot of businesses we don't talk about or think about anymore, but were swallowed up by the likes of Google and Amazon and Facebook and so on.
Yeah. No. So one thing more to add to that point, Mark, that you mentioned, which I think is telling of the valuation, right? So if you look at the recent phenomenon of NFTs, I think Ethereum has attracted a lot less NFT projects than the likes of Flow and Cardano and Solana, only because of the cost structures and the evolution that has happened to say, hey, this is as good as that platform. And as an end user, let's say Derek loves his basketball team, you could really care less as long as you get the NFT that you want. Right. Mm-hmm. And so I think you begin to see that. Second data point to substantiate Mark's assertion is we have seen about 20% of total value locked, the TVL, which was predominantly in Ethereum, being moved to Solana in the last month or so.
Mm.
And combine the two together, right? Is the fact that yes, NFT, which is meant for purely retail, mass adoption, going after collectibles, art, sports, and all the other good things that go with it, predominantly being developed on the competitive elements of Ethereum, like Cardano and Solana and Flow, specialized sort of platforms for NFTs, and suddenly you begin to see some key DeFi projects moving to non. I think it's a sign of our times to say there is a competitive element here and who really comes out as a winner, which is what Mark was saying, that, you know, what is the network effect of this? And if you're pricing the consumers out of the network and you're only going after niche, well, maybe that's a strategy, but it doesn't really bode well in long term.
Look, this has been fascinating because, you know, for the audience, I hope you've enjoyed this. As I always say, if you haven't enjoyed this, I guess you won't listen again. But I hope you've enjoyed this, because what we're hearing here is we're hearing somebody with a deep knowledge of blockchain, which is Nitin, but also with a decade of payment gateway expertise. In other words, you've worked with and for the banks for a long, long time. A vast majority of what we've talked about is algorithm-driven payment systems. And so you've got that extraordinary knowledge. And what Mark's done is he's bought into this context. Yes. So here it sits. These valuations are like that. But look at what happened in the dot-com period, and look at what happened with those. Look at what happened in, look at what we see in the mature space of the marketplace. You know, for example, Coinbase listed for $100 billion, whereas the Intercontinental Exchange, which is the New York Stock Exchange, was only valued at $67 billion. Why? Because this space has this enormous upside to it. So I think between the two of you, you know, it's just been great always to be able to have conversations around this and get everyone's perspective in. So it was a good reason we invited Nitin along, Mark along. Hey, Nitin, to add context to it. But what we're also seeing is we're seeing this, and that is we're part of this community, we're getting noticed. And so next week, it might be interesting to cover a couple of these topics, because I look on CoinDesk, which I thoroughly enjoy reading. And if anyone's really interested in this space, CoinDesk is like the New York Times for this space. And I look at a few of the headings, and the headings go as follows. SEC threatens to sue Coinbase over lending product. And then it says, state of crypto, the SEC takes on DeFi. And then underneath that, it says, Australian crypto and remittance businesses face debanking, says Senate committee. Well, guess what? Clearly we have their attention, because they're starting to try and work out how to stop it and how to regulate it. But on the other hand, El Salvador is enacting a Bitcoin law. And so I think it's interesting to see the called developed countries fighting the issue around what this might mean to their industries, and the developing countries taking this on board and saying, bring it on, we want to compete. And I don't know, maybe that's a topic for next week.
Sure. Now, that's interesting. Cuba and El Salvador and Philippines, I think there's a whole global phenomenon around this. And you're right. I think what we've seen in the United States and mostly developed economies, because they have more to lose, they have a structure in place. I think there's a little bit to be said about, you know, that we build all the structure and suddenly you're breaking the structure, whereas there's little structure in Cuba and in El Salvador. So yes, we should certainly spend more time. I think this is super interesting, both in terms of regulatory and compliance framework.
Terrific. So of course, for those that are still listening, please subscribe and like and share, because we're here to share with the community. We will get to a point where we'll come out every Thursday morning early Southern Hemisphere time. We'll intentionally get that out so that people can listen to this on the way to work, in the train or in the car or whatever they happen to be doing, jogging. And we'll keep that as a fairly much a routine. And we thank you very much. If you've got any comments that you wish to put forward, or you want questions answered, or a topic that we're totally up for listening to that. So you can connect with me at DERYCK at portal.am, or Nitin at NITIN at portal.am. And we'll look forward to seeing whether we can accommodate your questions along the way. And for now, thank you everybody for enjoying and being involved with this great set of topics. Thank you, guys.
Thanks, guys. See you next week. Thanks, Mark.